Okay, we're going to stop there on the Daily Evolver. This was an interview of Jeff Salzman and Ken Wilber on Donald Trump from an integral philosophy perspective on different kinds of historical precedents that have led and have fertilized the ground for the sprouting of this new presidency. I have with me Mitchell Sapanczyk. Mitchell, you're on.
Hi.
And Mitchell, why don't you introduce yourself to the greater radio audience?
Certainly. My name is Mitchell Sapanczyk. My website is www.szcz.org. My day job is software developer, but my secret identity is that of a political activist working particularly on media issues. I've been involved, for the most part, with two groups that have been working on media stuff. One, Chicago Media Action, online at chicagomediaaction.org, as well as the Chicago Independent Media Center, online at chicago.indymedia.org, indie media spelled I-N-D-Y-M-E-D-I-A. I have served and still serve as a producer of Chicago Indie Media's monthly television series, Chicago Independent Television, which you can watch on CAN TV, cable channel 19, on the first and the third Monday of the month at 11 o'clock in the evening, or online, go to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/CIMC.
Thank you, Mitchell. That was fantastic, and I don't know how you do it.
I don't either.
But I think we're all driven, we're all on fumes right now with what's been going on. Now, I had you on, I'd say back in what?
October. Yeah. I actually checked it up. It was October.
Yeah. And
October 23rd. I actually have it here.
Yes. Yes. I do recall I was going to give you some recipes for crow fricassee and crow casserole because I told you that I didn't think Hillary had a snowball's chance in Hades to win the presidency, and you're like, oh, no, everything's going to be fine.
You were right. I was wrong.
So, and why? Because not for any other reason, we're both really smart people, but unlike you, I don't think maybe, I don't know, do you have family members that supported Trump?
I probably do. In the immediate of those who have talked about it, I think that they have all at least didn't support Trump. They're probably confined a couple and probably know of off. I don't know anyone in the immediate offhand.
A whole wide swath of my family tree supported Trump.
Okay.
And so I having that, you know, upfront and personal, mm-hmm. I sort of knew what was coming down the pike. And so I'm, like anyone else, I was really stunned that he won.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so adamant about him not becoming president that I actually registered Republican to vote in the primary because I didn't want him to even get the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do whatever I could, even if it meant having to hold my nose and register as a Republican, mm-hmm. and vote as a Republican, which I've done on occasion to make a point or to get someone off the ballot. And what was really interesting to me, and during the election season, I was actually approached by the city of Chicago to be an election judge because I was the only Republican.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In my precinct. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. But, yeah, I'm just as shocked and awed as anyone that he won, really.
Now, I don't know what surveys or research has been done about whether or not how widely were people surprised at the outcome? I mean, I imagine there were a fair number of people that kind of were hoping, but nonetheless, they were kind of like, oh, he won't win, because they were reading the same tea leaves that everyone else was, that were saying a Hillary win and probably a claim in the Senate. But no, it turns out that wasn't the case. We saw the firewall, as it was called, three states that had gone Democratic, I believe, in every election, going back at least the last, four, maybe five presidential elections had switched. Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania had all went Republican rather than Democrat. There it seemed like the my reading of the tea leaves is that the reason they switched is because a fair number of voters who were enthusiastic Democrats were less than enthused about the candidate that were at play there. And it was close enough. And in fact, the margins of probably in the order of maybe a quarter million in all three states combined were enough to switch the presidency. And also, especially in a close election where that bleed over would have also meant additional votes for the Democrat in two of those three states. Both Wisconsin and Pennsylvania were having Democrats up for the Senate in the re-election. You would have seen that they probably would have won, or at least made it a lot more of a close race. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. Republicans held both seats.
It really astounded me at the major losses that the Democrats sustained during the election. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did not anticipate that much damage, even though I anticipated, unlike many of our ilk, I anticipated a Trump presidency. I did. Mm-hmm. I did not think that he would have the level of Republican backlash.
Yeah, it was. Go on.
Yeah, so backlash is, I think, a good word.
You're right that, whether or not you could have predicted a presidency, whoever would have won as president, the fact, though, is that at least in the, by Trump having a sweep of the remaining houses of Congress that Republicans held, they actually lost a little bit in the House.
A little bit.
Yeah, but they still held it. There was still enough of a margin that they were able to easily hold.
Yeah.
And the Democrats, where this year would have been the year to try to claim it, they needed to flip four seats. They wound up ultimately flipping just two seats.
Well, two is better than none.
That's true. It's a lot closer.
Yeah.
And that actually allows for a little bit of a narrower margin and less of an option that Republicans, for them to be able to take when it comes to legislation. It also accords for something like what we had seen with, and being from Michigan, not only did I know her, but I also knew how to pronounce her name, Betsy DeVos, your education secretary. And please let the radio audience know that our wizardress is rolling her eyes at me mentioning her name. Being from Michigan, and particularly from Grand Rapids, which is also where the DeVos family hails from, there's DeVos Hall, DeVos Center, and the DeVoses had been, well, they had co-founded the franchise Amway and were had become billionaires as a result.
Network marketing.
Yeah, the network marketing for which they've been under tremendous criticism, not the least of which by their own employees.
Yeah, well, some of it was
class action lawsuits and a notable 1980 book called Amway, The Cult of Free Enterprise by Amway employee who basically peeled the curtain behind and showed the dismal state of affairs regarding Amway.
Well, you know, with any kind of, there's always something. I mean, but I can say quite honestly that I like the Amway dishwashing liquid. It was very concentrated and it lasted a long time.
I'm not saying that you couldn't necessarily buy Amway products. I'm just simply saying that they made their wealth become tremendous right-wing political power players. And they've been for quite a while.
Not an endorsement.
I'm not saying it's an endorsement.
I wanted the radio audience to know that.
Okay. All right. Great.
I'm trying to cover myself there.
So, yeah. But in any event, Betsy DeVos had been part of the DeVos family that had not been shy regarding using you routinely see, or at least when they were alive, the co-founders of Amway. Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel, both of whom have since passed on, but who, when they were alive, would routinely rank in the top 10 or top 20 of the both Forbes and Fortune rankings of the wealthiest people in the world. They were worth each in the billions. And their families have since inherited that money and have used it for political activism of a right-wing flavor. And Betsy DeVos is just the latest incarnation of that. She had been a right-wing political in Michigan politics, certainly in the education front.
So what? Why? I mean, what was her motive? I mean, what's her motivation? Why? I mean, I'm probably sounding as daft as she did. I've been thinking about that a little bit. Honestly, I'm just trying to. I know that she was most likely a very heavy supporter of Trump, right? Giving him probably a huge contribution, maybe.
Probably so. I don't know the numbers on that.
Party. It could be that particular pack.
It stands to reason. Maybe the Republican Party, maybe that wasn't the exact flavor of Republican she liked.
I'm not going to make any kind of statement that I can't verify, but I would imagine that would have definitely played a part in her nomination, because there are aren't there other people that would have possibly been conservative but may have had a little bit more background in education?
Oh, sure. There's no shortage of folks like that.
Sure, there are. And but she is that bellwether, or any of Trump's candidates mm-hmm. for his cabinet. Mm-hmm. You have to question their credentials in terms of whether or not they are that they would be typically qualified for a governmental position. I'm not saying that these folks probably don't have some smarts or that they wouldn't be able to do any kind of work, but I was kind of hoping, against hope perhaps, that, even if we were going to be dealing with a Republican regime, that we would be dealing with some people, maybe I didn't believe what they believed, but I knew that had some experience in government, had some experience working in a bureaucracy, knew how to navigate the system and work within the system to get those changes made, even if I didn't agree with
them. Yes, and that would be, under ideal circumstances, what you would imagine / hope for, that you would have someone who would... while they may, in fact, you would sometimes see what's proverbially called the revolving door, that people would sometimes switch from the government sector to the private sector, then back in or something like that. But at least they would know about it and know how to work those systems.
Right.
And work within those systems. Admittedly, they've got their own axe to grind and they've got their own agenda to push, and they will at least work within those systems to try to push those agendas, that agenda or agendas, whatever they are. Yes.
Correct. But that's not the case here.
No, here it's like the equivalent of you want to build a bridge and all you've got is dynamite. You're all you can do is just blow things up. And
absolutely.
that seems like that's what's going on here. That he's just like saying, okay, in fact, you might say this maybe uncannily so for nearly every candidate that he's putting forth for each of them. They are, their job is to basically destroy what they're set out to lead.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they have any experience in it, and a great many of them don't. I mean, to my experience, to my knowledge, it's like certainly not Betsy DeVos, whose background is has never taught, has never even been a school administrator, is basically an advocate, and whose sole credential, even by the admission of people who voted for her, was that she donated millions of dollars to Republicans.
Yeah,
you could make the same claim regarding Rex Tillerson, who, to my knowledge, has never served as a some kind of diplomat or some kind of, he's your ExxonMobil former CEO who resigned last year and is now, actually just was confirmed, Secretary of State.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then who else do we have in the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
Ben Carson.
If I only had...
Who lived in housing when he was a kid, and that was about it.
I guess that's some experience.
That's some experience,
more
but
than the other candidates.
That's true too. It's basically a rogues gallery, and
rogues gallery. That's great.
Yeah, I would have said Murderer's Row, but I think that would have been a little bit too morbid. Rogues Gallery, I think we'll say.
I think Rogues Gallery is a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, and these are the cabinet officials who will be trying to do what they can to try to advance their policy and along the lines of, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Absolutely. They'll just try to ram through their policy, their agenda, their ideals, or whatever they want to do, or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it boggles, it really hurts my head to think about it. You know, I sometimes feel like the little Barbie that said math is hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and the Trump presidency is hard. It's like I can't wrap my head around just how awful it is.
Yes. However, it is to be said that people are not taking this lying down. We have seen since the inauguration, just 3 weeks ago, on January 20th, a remarkable resurgence, probably to a level that I can't recall, even at the height of various protest movements that I've been a party to, I've been involved with, or that I have even seen, across the United States and kind of with extensions around the world. I mean,
the Women's March.
Well, that's one example. The Women's March that we had seen, that was on January 21st. I mean, where the levels were, I mean, certainly in Washington, D.C., more than three times the size of the crowd that actually showed up for the inauguration itself. Here in Chicago, the numbers, the estimates that they were expecting of people to show up were probably in the ballpark of about 50,000, give or take 10,000. The numbers of that would probably have to be multiplied by five by the number of people who actually showed up. Estimates of upwards of 250,000 people who attended, who were so big they actually couldn't march because they actually enveloped the entire march route. You actually did have splitter formations actually did march in unannounced places throughout the downtown and in nearby neighborhoods.
You're talking about Washington,
D.C.? I'm talking about Chicago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it was massive. It ranked among the very biggest protests in Chicago history. The very biggest one was 11 years ago, the big protests on May Day against the anti-immigration actions of the Sensenbrenner bill. James Sensenbrenner, former, I think he still is, a representative from Wisconsin,
yes,
who had been advocating for very draconian measures regarding immigration policy and drew huge protests. In Chicago, upwards of 1 million people, maybe conservatively speaking, 750,000 people. That ranks as the biggest as far as anyone knows.
Yeah.
What happened on January 21st in Chicago probably is second. And maybe third is, might even have to go all the way back to the protests for the 8-hour day back in the 1880s. There were protests there that were reported by media at the time of 100,000, 200,000, something like that.
So, okay, let me ask you.
So it was big. And that was just the first salvo in a very impressive stream of activism to come. But sorry, I interrupted you.
No,
go ahead.
No, that's okay. No, really, it's okay, because one of the things that I'm, you know, having family members who supported Trump and who are like Fox heads and, you know, they've dove down the foxhole. They were saying to me, like, examples of the kinds of statements I would hear had to do with, the protests don't know what they're protesting.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of that? Can't they just grow up and realize that they lost? And
did they complain about paid protesters?
Too. this is the destruction of our society.
Mm-hmm, right.
Oh, this is terrible. All of these things. And I'm like, wait, Dad, you were in the... You were jailed during the 1968 riots in the Democratic Convention, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously? And you're telling me that they're terrible? What happened? So anyway, I think it's because they live in Arizona and their brains are baked. Seriously, I get a lot of that reaction from that side of the fence politically. And so what do you think? I mean, why do you think people are protesting? What do you think they what do you think they intend on accomplishing? I know that seems like a really dumb question, but mm-hmm. I really mean that. For someone who doesn't get it,
mm-hmm.
What would you say?
Why protest? At a minimum, to exercise your rights to free speech and to express disfavor at things. I mean, that's why I've protested on things, on policies or on actions that others have taken. Now, does that mean that my protest will automatically mean that they'll be enlightened and change their policies? Probably not. Very rarely does that actually happen. However, it does not only send a message and inspire others to also, I guess, at a minimum, learn about the issue, which a lot of times has been, in my experience, the biggest obstacle. Admittedly, I'm kind of working in a field that is kind of abstruse and is so abstruse that just explaining the issue is usually sufficient to, and once people get it and click, it has a kind of resonance to be able to cross across usual political lines, dividing lines, and as a result, hopefully motivate people to take action, usually in some form of writing to your representatives or writing to the FCC or something like that. And then that would, that actually can be then used as grist for later action down the road. Like, for example, I'll mention the classic example, the FCC media ownership fight of 2003,
right,
which I had been a part of involving, where the FCC was lock, stock, and barrel, ready to just gut the remaining media ownership rules so that a single company could own all the media in a single town. This was about 2002, 2003, where they were trying to ram this through.
And
they had everything ready.
And we're going to be revisiting that topic.
Yes, we will.
Very, very shortly. But
going to the point of protest,
yeah,
what wound up happening, yeah, not to dive too far afield on the topic of media, but going on to the issue of protest,
yeah,
we spent, I and others in Chicago Media Action and affiliated groups, spent the better part of a year telling people about it, informing folks, organizing events, organizing, in one case, a couple of protests, organizing public actions, serving as a resource for people to appearing on radio stations. I had appeared on three in the run-up for that.
I'm not stopping you. I'm just sort of like, you know, kind of adding that footnote. These are things that people can do.
Yes, these are things people can do. We did them. I did them. There wasn't any kind of particular experience. And mind you, I had been rather new as far as getting into political activism. I mean, I've done it now for quite a while, so I'm kind of a little bit of a seasoned veteran at this stuff.
Right.
But at the time, I wasn't. And I had to basically learn my way around this.
Yeah.
But there was nothing, no one said you couldn't do this, and no one said that I needed some kind of special qualifications. It's like the old line goes, the only degree you need is a degree of caring. And that's what I had.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then a lot of times, especially for this political activism, you may feel like, I don't have any necessary special qualifications. A lot of times you don't. It's like, if you care enough to want to be involved on it, that's plenty. In fact, that's a lot of times more than enough.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the thing that I've experienced as a political activist, as a feminist, as someone who, you know, worked in pro-choice,
mm-hmm,
was part of the first March for Women's Lives,
mm-hmm, yep,
you know, who raised money and did house meetings and, you know, and if it were 1966 instead of 1986, I would have been part of the Jane Collective. You
right.
know what I'm saying?
Yep. Yep.
I would have been one of those.
The what we're referring to is pre-Roe abortion providers.
Right. And
yeah.
You know what? And who I am.
Before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal in the United States in 1972.
To get someone from the Jane Collective to come on.
To be fair, I actually did interview someone who wrote the book about Jane on my radio program. You can look it up on my archive.
Oh, okay.
So you may want to feel free to download that and play that on WZRD if you like.
I will. And
yeah.
I also feel like it's important to talk to some of the founders that I think still are alive.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them were the founders of the Chicago Women's Health Center.
Yes.
So I might have to activate my network. I'm just been very preoccupied with the day job. So
mm-hmm.
Anyway, so yeah, but one of the things I learned as an activist, or one of the things I experienced as an activist, because of the nature of feminism being as controversial then as it is now, as it will always be, I guess, is, you know, running headlong into opposition.
Right.
And in my case, you know, in any, you know, and I know a lot of other people who would resonate with this, you know, having to deal with the pro-life movement. Mm-hmm. And the radicalization of the right, you know, really started in the 70s. After Roe v.
Wade, right?
Which makes it's kind of odd if you really learn about the history of. I'm just using this as an example,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going off topic too much, really. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of, you know, taking a little trip, and we'll come back to the point. but the point, so what happened is that there's always been historically, like, opposition to. Progress, you know, resistance to change.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of course, feminists are still, by and large, demonized, even though there are mm-hmm. many, there are actually some right-wing feminists, believe it or not, they exist. The Independent Women's Forum comes to mind. That is, you know, so antithetical to people's understanding of the world. Now, I think now we've gotten to a point in our development culturally where we accept more of some of the things that were really radical 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You can
right.
say that. And I think about, for example, the LGBT, gay rights, marriage, all of that stemmed from and kind of was a trajectory of what was going on with the feminist movement.
Mm-hmm.
There's definite roots and connections there,
yes,
in that family tree. But yeah, dealing with the resistance was always part and parcel of whatever protest, whatever political activity I did. I always ran into someone who would say, "Oh, but you're a baby killer. You're this. You know," and demonize me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I would go to a protest. Like, an example, I go to a protest, and one guy actually put a. I'm not kidding. As I am sitting here, he had a dead baby in a bell jar. Like, I don't know where he got it from. Chicago.
Whoa.
Science and Supply. He said, "This is what you kill. This is what you kill." I'm like, wait a minute. That and what I'm advocating are two different
yes.
things. And, you know, and of course, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I got used to. I mean, I got used to, oh, okay, I'm going to have to deal with that. I would go, and I know a lot of people who were like with me, who did things like I did and have had other experiences where they've met resistance, where they were jailed, where they were, you know, ostracized by their family. So there is a cost politically to getting involved. So what do you think is going to happen under the Trump administration? Do you think that with all of this protest, that there will be a backlash against it?
Yes, I do think that there will try to be a backlash against it because.
And what do you think should be done? That's the second part of my
question. What should be done? Now, that's a great question. The short answer to that second question is a lot. But right now, I think we're kind of. At least for the next 2 years, among at least in the federal level, but also to a great extent to a great majority of places at the local level, kind of resorting to having to play defense, to try to stop things from getting worse in terms of policy and in terms of advances that have been won. Now, as far as what will happen, in a lot of ways, there's some rules regarding the criminalization of dissent. I mean, we had seen that, I mean, even throughout certainly the George W. Bush years, a little less so during the Obama years, but you still had that, where you had, like, for example,
absolutely.
I mean, just here in Chicago, you had protesters who were disappeared, but who we later found out were basically put into a secret, the Holman Square location, a secret, what they call a black site. A secret police site for interrogation and torture.
No kidding.
Yeah, and that was in 2012, and that was in Chicago. I mean, we're not talking about ancient history here. We're talking within the lifespan of everyone listening to this broadcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not we're not talking about like Mars. We're talking about within the city limits. and where you can go to within a reasonably easy drive or train ride to the location, and which is and where there were protests, they were active against it, and there were efforts to try to rope criminalize people who were involved in that. And these were folks who were and who were later found out to have been targeted and also were trapped by police, as we now know from later investigations that bore this out.
And there's a court record and testimony.
It's all on record. I mean, you might not hear about it, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen.
You can actually get copies and find all of this.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably not more than an internet search or two away from finding out about this in great detail. I mean, there's one great strength regarding the internet, but that's another topic we'll save on. What will happen, they'll try to probably extend that further. I mean, even within the, not even all that long ago, 3 weeks ago, at the protests, and there were protests in Washington, D.C., against Trump at the time of the inauguration. Something like 230 arrests for people basically being held on felony riot charges for a protest. Now, whether or not what they did qualifies as a felony riot, but nonetheless, I mean, going to jail for 10 years is a pretty heady prospect, and having that as a record on you for the rest of your life, that's pretty scary.
I think this is going to be a golden age for criminal defense attorneys. I mean, I said that when, as soon as he was elected, I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be the Lawyers Full Employment Act. I mean, we're really, really going to be working very, very hard.
Few things here to, I mean, certainly there will be grist for the mill for attorneys, certainly fighting on both sides. Nonetheless, I'm reading what's happening as far as the increasing widespread dissent, and we just talked about the Women's March, but I mean, you can also count as a big example protests, particularly at airports, regarding the immigration ban. That actually, I would say, helped to fuel the court orders that actually put that block in place. That order is at the moment a dead letter. Now the problem is that people who may try to apply are going to have to for visas who may be living in one of the seven countries that are targeted by the Trump administration in the wake of this in this order. If they want to try to get visas to the United States, they're going to have to apply to the State Department, and guess who's in charge of that? Rex Tillerson, the same ExxonMobil freak who is now. I mean, but that's the thing. It's like they may try to win a little bit on that score, but nonetheless. The protests are there, they were huge, and they at least rolled it back, at least in part, and in pretty significant part. Now the Trump administration is trying to figure out, what do we do next? They could try to appeal that to what happened here is lawsuit, emergent. Trump rules down regarding the anti-immigration ban. Within a day, emergency court order is heard and filed in New York, and puts an emergency stay, probably in New York, maybe in wider areas. Another court order is actually filed in Seattle, Washington. In the court, there the court case, Washington v. Trump, saying this is, this is a violation of rules and laws as they exist. You can't do this without going through channels. You can't just simply, we have laws and rules and courts and things like that. What you did...
have an existing infrastructure enforce and place in a ban. So it's not like that, and that's the thing that I've been trying to explain to some family members is that, look, the issue is not that there is a bunch of starry-eyed hippies who are saying, unicorns, rainbows, we accept everybody.
Right.
It's more hardened, experienced lawyers who say, hey, wait, we have a rule of law we have to enforce here.
Yes.
We have systems and procedures that work. And we have to have faith in them, and they have to be implemented in order to get these kinds
of... It's the crazy idea. Yeah, it's the crazy idea to obey the law.
Hello.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that Seattle court case saw a defeat that for the Trump administration. So the ban was overturned. An appeal was filed to its to its superior court in the Ninth Circuit.
In the Ninth Circuit, yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
No, it's Ninth Circuit Court, which
I'm very familiar with. Yeah, working with
this
the
is
Ninth
out
Circuit.
Of out of San Francisco, but it represents basically the Western states.
I know exactly yeah. where that is.
Yeah,
and the thing about, I call it the wacky Ninth Circuit.
Wacky.
It is the wacky Ninth Circuit. It is pretty liberal. I mean, let's just say, for example, if we're in the
but
Second or Eighth
they
Circuit,
they affirmed it.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. I read the ruling.
I know, but our listeners may not.
Okay,
so.
But I'm just saying, I know that the listeners may not have read the ruling because they don't work in the law biz and they don't have access to Lexis, but actually, you can get the ruling online anyway.
Yeah.
And also, as a point of fact, for anyone who's interested, you can go to the Ninth Circuit website, just type in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and you can actually watch the oral arguments
yeah.
in play, and
they,
you can actually get a transcript of the same.
They recorded play. The arguments in a conference call, and live streamed the
yeah
live streamed it.
It's been interesting. It was very interesting. And so exactly, and so I get these emails from my various family members saying, you know, the world is coming to an end. They're all a bunch of idiots. What do they know? And I was like, Dad, you know. I would be saying that if they ruled against it, if they ruled for Trump, because I believe in the system and I know that there is a way of dealing with it.
They asked some very pointed questions, not the least of which was, can you point to, I mean, not terribly complicated questions, can you point to even a single example of where this this policy would stop harm? And they couldn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just saying about, we're talking about, we're kind of being legalistic about this, but this had direct impact on people's lives.
Yes, very much so.
I mean, a baby, I kept on saying that to my coworker, a baby couldn't come into the country because it was a Syrian baby.
Right.
A baby who had, you know, like.
Who just happened to be born in Syria.
Right.
Who right.
was coming to the States for facial reconfiguring surgery mm-hmm. or something like that.
Probably like a cleft palate fix or something
exactly.
like that.
I don't know exactly what the nature of the surgery mm-hmm. was. This was in the New York Times and the Boston Globe. And a baby. You know, it's like I think it was under the same kind of program that the girls from Hiroshima getting plastic surgery for free from the American College of Dermatology after the bomb dropped.
Right.
In the 50s, they did plastic surgery on them.
Mm.
And it was all like a big media event and everything. But I think
oh my God, you're helping the Japanese.
Yeah, but actually it was a great coup. It did a lot to change the nature of you know, the discourse between the Japanese and the Americans after
yeah.
the bomb was dropped and so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think those policies have been in place for a long time that we, you know, have these kind of humanistic medical exchanges that have been going on for decades,
mm-hmm.
for a century, almost a century. I mean, we're talking 70 years.
Right.
And then to say all of a sudden, boom, no babies from Syria, period. Come in for correct facial corrective surgery.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that? That's bad policy, but it has a direct impact on people's lives, and it has repercussions, not just with the people who were detained at the airport, but all the people who are trying to get here
yeah.
to begin with. And even though the ban has been the ban was appealed and so on,
yeah.
it doesn't stop the Trump attorneys. Or the administration's attorneys for filing a motion for reconsideration.
Yeah, they'll try
which, you know,
to file
it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of an unclear question. They could file on what's referred to as an en banc appeal, where they'll try to. There were three judges that heard this, but they could have like the entirety of
absolutely.
All the judges. That's something like 19 judges all hear it. That's rare. That's hard to do, and that doesn't happen often, especially for a case that was ruled unanimously 3-0.
Yeah.
In this favor. They could try to appeal that to the Supreme Court, but at least whether or not Gorsuch gets nominated as your ninth judge.
Yeah.
And even in the best case scenario, that'll probably happen in, it could be like 4 months before that even happens.
But yeah, but 4 months can mean a lot to, I mean, it could mean a lot. In 4 months, anything can happen.
But
so
my point is, he wouldn't be able to do it right away.
Yeah. this is true.
It would take a while at a minimum, and they probably want to file an appeal to the Supreme Court as soon as possible, and probably say we want to hear this as soon as possible.
But this thing brings
you'd only have eight judges hearing it.
I know we could talk. I mean, I'm sorry, both of us kind of.
Yeah, we're kind of legal nerds.
We're kind of getting into
but returning back to the activism issue, here would we even be talking about that without that activism? I argue not. I mean, a lot of times judges are kind of, you may have judges who try to avoid and pretend to be neutral arbiters, as is their job ostensibly. But nonetheless, they understand that if they're getting watched or if there are protests happening, and sometimes very big protests, they understand that what they do has particular significance, and I can bet you that they will probably be more careful and hopefully rule with an understanding for that. There's actually a book called The Hollow Hope that basically talks about activist efforts through the courts without coupled with being in the streets.
I always forget my notebook.
That's okay. I got a pen. It's a book called The Hollow Hope.
The Hollow Hope.
The Hollow Hope.
Okay.
And it talks about actually this kind of intersection between lawsuits and activism of the kind of more of the nature where you're marching out in the streets, you've got signs, you're chanting, the kinds of things that people would typically associate with political protests. And a lot of times they're showing that unless you've got the political protests, the lawsuits don't really amount to very much. And they actually look at some examples of cases that didn't have that and failed, but examples that did have it and succeeded.
Okay, so I understand correctly. So he's the author is suggesting that protest has more impact than lawsuits.
No, the lawsuit, they're both necessary.
Okay.
You need the lawsuit because that's the actual formal mechanism for challenging a particular policy with you disagree.
Okay.
But that's just the tip of the spear.
Right.
The spear is, wider awareness, and preferably in the form of engaged political activism, protest, and that sort of thing. That's the point. I mean, it's like you would not have seen actions, certainly regarding Roe v. Wade, if there wasn't a movement afoot,
absolutely.
A very big movement that was active saying, women are people too, we demand the rights to be able to control our own bodies.
In the case of two landmark Supreme Court decisions, Roe v. Wade and Brown versus Board of Education.
Mm-hmm.
Those are good ones that come to mind.
Right.
About how the historical precedents before they became law, go back several decades before the decisions were actually issued, and that's especially true with the Brown, because it goes back to the Dred Scott what was the one that was decided by Oliver Wendell Holmes in the 1890s, and Dred Scott, and then Brown v. Board of Education, separate but equal.
Oh, Plessy v. Ferguson.
Ferguson. Yeah, there you go. And then Brown v.
Board of Education in the 1950s.
It was to kind of overthrew Plessy v. Ferguson.
But so, there were 60 years of difference between the two.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're talking, these changes that started as small movements that burgeon, but here, I think what we have is you might be able to make a case historically. I'm talking from a philosophical and not from a media or a political perspective entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But there might be actually historical precedents to why we have so many big protests now. Is I think people are fighting to keep what has been
won right
already.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about like we're fighting against anything, we're fighting for something, which is completely different.
Yeah, and that helps, actually, because there, and we'll talk about this more when we get into the net neutrality protest, fighting with that kind of incumbency helps a lot, because you've not only seen it in play, and you also have seen that, especially where people will sometimes trot out boogeymen to try to reverse one or another policy. you can actually say that, yes, gay people can get married and the sky won't fall. Mm-hmm. And you know, bad things won't happen just because a policy that some right-wing political may disagree with happens to become law. And, you know, it's not like, you know, they may disagree with it, but it doesn't, you know, life goes on.
Do you think we have, let's just say for the sake of argument, and it's certainly within the realm of possibility, given the fact that, you know, the band of rogues we have in the cabinet, mm-hmm. That it is entirely possible that these things can be repealed and reversed? And do you think that, and what I keep telling people is the culture's changed. The horse is out of the barn. We can't just put it back.
That's, it's a complicated question. That's a great question. And I suppose it's always contextual. I mean, there are probably some things that are probably going to be easier to reverse than others. Mm-hmm. And it may just depend on the particular issue. I'll hold off my comments regarding the net neutrality fight, which people will almost certainly try to reverse. And I'll tell you at this moment right now, they won't be able to do it right away for lots of other reasons. We can get into that in a bit. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it'll depend on the issues at play. In the case of legal abortion, this has been a fight that has been going on, and certainly on the local level, for quite a while. And they now see that where they think they can have their opportunity in the Supreme Court, where they think they will be able to have a right-wing majority, or at least enough of one, and can file a suit that will hopefully wind its way to the Supreme Court, that will then maybe be able to get that 5-4 decision that they need to be able to undo Roe v. Wade and reverse that policy back to the states, as it had been before Roe v. Wade.
And that's the way it was, yeah.
Yeah, and that would mean that abortion would basically be a right on a state-by-state basis in the United States. I should actually mention one other fact related to that. I didn't know this until after the election. Illinois has a trigger law making Illinois an automatic anti-abortion state should Roe v. Wade be abolished.
Yes.
There are four states in the United States, and Illinois is one of them, where if Roe v. Wade is overturned, Illinois automatically becomes an anti-abortion state. Abortion would be made illegal automatically in this state.
Uh-huh.
And that may be something that folks, if people are looking for something to work on in the next couple of years, and we've got an election coming up in 2018, this may be something to consider as far as something to do.
Absolutely.
You may want to try to revisit that trigger law.
Well, yes, and get that changed,
yeah.
If anything. You know, and that's why I think a lot of people gave to the ACLU.
and you've also found since the election, a lot of people, if they couldn't take back their vote or re-vote again or something, they can at least vote with their pocketbook. And so you've seen like huge windfalls for nonprofit and all kinds of activism groups.
I think this is a good, in some ways, I think this is a good thing because it's active, it sort of energized a lot of people who normally would have just said, oh, it's just, you know, it is the way it is. Let's just go shopping.
Yeah.
Forget about it.
And that I take hope from that. That people are, they're active, they're involved, and a lot of people are getting involved for the first time. That is a big, big change because a lot of times the other side wins when one side falls asleep or is apathetic. Mm-hmm. If they're active, even after the fact, they may stay active. And that may come to burn them in unexpected ways later on. I've seen that time and again. That's actually why I've gotten involved.
Absolutely.
And I had gone from someone who was just didn't really care to someone who is deeply caring, deeply involved. I'll vote in every election. But I'm not going to just stop at going once a year to my local polling place and, you know, spending a few minutes in a polling booth marking out lines on a ballot. It's more than that, and it can be done in lots of ways. You don't have to do this, you know, full bore every waking hour of your moment. You don't have to spend a lot to do a lot to make a positive impact.
Absolutely, and you know what? You don't even have to get politically involved necessarily. There is such a thing as cultural resistance. I mean, I think about the comedians. I mean, this is a golden age right now that we're dealing with. You have you watched any of the, you know?
So you're talking about Saturday Night Live or
oh my gosh,
Colbert on CBS.
This is the improvisers wet dream here.
Oh, no, I mean like, comedians are,
frothing at the mouth at the deliciousness of humor and comedy and political.
Yeah.
Satire.
It's an embarrassment of riches on that stuff.
It really is.
By the way, John Oliver comes back to his new season tonight.
Yay!
I am looking forward to my YouTube
thank
subscription
you
being updated.
And thank you for introducing me to John
You're
Oliver.
Very welcome.
I appreciate
that. Last Week Tonight comes back for its new season tonight on HBO, and
not
also not an endorsement, and also will be rebroadcast on YouTube immediately after the show ends.
Yes, yes.
So I'll probably be watching it from my lunch break tomorrow.
From your local library.
Yeah.
If you don't have cable.
But I mean, they, to their credit, they post a fair amount of those segments online.
Yes, true.
Yeah, so
true,
so
true, true. Oh, my
so
goodness.
You can also watch it, you know, on the Last Week Tonight channel on YouTube.
But I think there is a lot to be said about the cultural resistance. I mean, I think there is something to be said about, here's an example of a small amount of resistance. When I was when I first started my career as a legal staffer,
mm-hmm.
I worked for the bad guys. And I found a button on one of the, some left-wing website. But I loved it. It said, proudly serving my corporate masters.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. So I wore the pin to work.
Okay.
And one of the partners looked at my pin and said, proudly serving my corporate masters. And he said, and I said, well, aren't you? You know, meaning.
Well, aren't you?
Aren't you? Aren't we? Isn't that what we're doing?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a form of protest, but it was also humorous. I mean, I'm using that as an example, but there are other examples that people use.
Mm.
I think another example, more recent example, is the pussy cap. You know, the pussy cap.
Yes,
you
yes.
You know, people, girl, young women and men knitting caps that look like little cats,
yes.
Which I think are really cute and not very hard to do knitty-wise. I know I'm a knitter.
And there are probably videos and introductory guides
but
of various
great,
sorts.
That's a great form of resistance.
And it's taken off.
Yeah.
It's
taken off. I mean, I don't think, I think it's a form of resistance. It's definitely something worth doing. And all the t-shirts, the memorabilia, I'm a nasty gal. I mean, I'm using those as examples, but there are mm-hmm. others. There are others that other people can utilize, you're in, you're out,
Right, right.
kind of things. Now that brings me to another question
mm-hmm.
before we hit the net neutrality, which we will spend the next hour on. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
just an hour.
I know.
Anyway, go on.
As usual, the time is going.
Yeah,
so
I know. But sorry, you were about to ask.
Okay, so here's the thing that one of the things I played before you came on was, Ken Wilber talking
mm-hmm.
about postmodernism
yeah.
and truth.
Right.
And truth seems to be a big word here in this whole thing, and I think that's really. I mean, I was thinking about that when I was reading some of the screed that I got from one of my relatives I sent some family members the copy of the Ninth Circuit opinion.
Okay.
And I said, just for your information, I didn't say it was wonderful, yay. No, I just said, here it is for your information, because this is, and I got it as soon as I could get it to them, because I knew that they're news junkies and they hadn't heard about it yet and hadn't hit the news. So I get this email back about how it's not true and what's going on and that all of this is a lie. And Trump says that. He says the lying media, the alternative facts, or even better, my favorite, is when Kellyanne goes and talks about the Bowling Green Massacre.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. Which never happened, which made me laugh out loud as
yeah.
I was reading it on the air, which is totally unprofessional, I admit, but I have to say, so what's the difference between a truth and a lie? I mean, are we not entering into this uncharted territory where who's really commanding the meta-narrative here? I mean, how do we take control of that?
That's a big question. It's one I've kind of worked on for a great amount of my political activism work through the media. There's a lot I could talk to, and I'll try to keep my remarks to maybe a couple minutes, especially since we're due for a break and a station ID and I have to get some water. but I'll say this. The kind of post-truth environment that we kind of a lot of people say we find ourselves mired in. This has been going on for a while. And you can find examples about this going back pretty far away. I can think of at least a quarter of a century back on a lot of particularly keen issues. I'll mention a couple. I mean, the classic example is that of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we went to war that we spent 7 years and untold billions of dollars, and not to mention probably upwards of, I don't even know, something like 4,000 American lives and however many untold Iraqi lives we didn't count.
Depends
and we'll never
the
know.
Source. You don't, they, yeah. even, they won't They're, even give us the right a number.
Odds are that those numbers probably don't even exist or hard to corroborate.
Because
but the point is, it's like that went in with basic, all that happened basically as a result of, you know, post-truth, fake lies, whatever you call it. That basically laid the groundwork for that. Take that away, we wouldn't have gone to war in Iraq. None of that would have happened.
No.
You can even go back a decade before that to the war, the first Gulf War in 1991, Operation Desert Storm.
Absolutely.
Part and there was one classic example about this that is, I'm happy to report has actually now gotten play, even to the level of a Wikipedia article, the Nuyura testimony. You know about this? Okay, well, I'll mention this just as a quick reminder. Nuyura was the name of a young woman, 15-year-old girl, who testified before the Congressional Human Rights Committee, saying that she had seen Iraqi soldiers working under Saddam Hussein tear babies out of incubators in an Iraqi hospital, or in a hospital. And we're laughing.
They were all from Bowling Green.
And they were all from Bowling Green. We laugh because, well, that's not true. It was actually coordinated by a PR firm, Hill & Knowlton. That Nuyura person, it turns out, was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador and also was a member of the Kuwaiti royal family. She was basically, and no evidence has been put forth to corroborate her testimony. None was found. It is now a lie. It is now confirmed as a lie to the point where if you were to look up Nuyura in Wikipedia, it is confirmed as such. Right there. Look it up. Nuyirah. It is referred to as the Nuyura testimony and is all confirmed. This was the not a bedrock, but one key point that helped us to go to war 26 years ago now.
Yeah,
in for Desert
that.
Storm.
I remember.
And it's like, okay, you're talking about, you know, lies and truth, facts and non-facts, you know, in the midst of Facebook and, you know, proverbial Macedonian teenagers who are basically ginning up Facebook likes and Google AdSense to try to make money to basically pawn off any old story that they can make. But this has been going on for a while.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's also been and more to the point where it's not just making, you know, for Macedonian teenagers to make a buck in their spare time. We're talking about the policy of an entire country going to war.
Nothing against Macedonia, just so you know.
But you see my point. Nothing against the people who are trying to earn money, especially in a turkey burger economy, never mind in the United States, but certainly in overseas. But my point is this isn't new. And this has also happened with some pretty considerable logistical and financial muscle behind it to try to convince a country to go to war. And that happened. Take that away. Would that have happened? Maybe, but the case would have been a lot harder to make otherwise. And that's what I'm getting at here regarding this stuff. Yes, we are kind of looking through the looking glass here on all this stuff, but it's not new. And it certainly has had substantial impacts of things, policies, affecting entire countries and people's lives in the past. We'll leave it there and we'll pick up after the break.
Sounds like a good plan. I think we both need one. this is heady discussion. But let's get to some music. And if you have any questions for our guest, Mitchell Szczepanczyk, the number here is area code 773-442-4578. And just call during the music. If you call while we're out talking, we're not going to answer the phone. It's just rude. Okay. So thanks. So thanks for listening. If you do have a question, please wait for the music and then call in. We just cannot take the calls on air. Unfortunately, we just do not have the infrastructure. My apologies for that. Okay. With that being said, if you do call in after me telling you that, that is rude. So there. All right. In the meantime, let's listen to some music. This is WZRD Chicago 88.3 FM on your radio dial. Thanks so much for listening. It is always an honor and pleasure to serve you, the greater WZRD listening community. We have Mitchell Sapanzik from Chicago Media Action, among other organizations and things that he does, on as our guest. Because we're a collective here at The Wizard. And hopefully you are finding this conversation interesting and edifying. And if you want to chime in, please do so during the music. And again, the number is 773-442-4578. Thanks so much. And here's some music. Okay, we're back. This is WZRD Chicago, 88.3 FM on your radio dial. My guest here this afternoon is Mitchell Sapanzik here from Chicago Media Action, among other organizations and activities. But now we are going to focus our energies and attention to net neutrality and the Trump administration and truth and all of that other good stuff. And then if we need to take the time to talk about other philosophical aspects of this particular time in history, we will do that too. But now we're going to focus on net neutrality. Mitchell, you're on.
And we should probably explain for the benefit of listeners who might not be 100% familiar with the concept what it is, and also a bit of the history on it. It's been a bone of policy contention, fights, including protests, for quite a while now, at least a decade plus. I've actually been working on the issue myself now 11 years in one capacity or another. The idea behind it is that it kind of bailed on the old common carrier idea of private resources doing a public good. The old notion is that, like, if you own a boat, but if you're carrying, say, the mail across the Erie Canal or something, that you're doing a public good, but you're doing it with a private resource, the boat you own. So what are the rules for that, and is that allowed? And the answer is yes, it's allowed, and the rules are spelled out in terms of what are referred to as common carriage. More broadly still, that extends to communications, particularly telecommunications. It had actually been the guiding principle regarding telephony, telephone calls. The idea that AT&T, as for much of American history, had been your telephone monopoly, got that position and had to abide by a number of rules, not the least of which was common carriage regarding content. They would be the monopoly, but they could not make the call, so to speak, of what content would be made on the networks that AT&T may own or control. And until the breakup of AT&T in 1983, it had taken quite a while to happen, that had basically been the law of the land. The principle, by and large, extended its way also to internet traffic, that internet service providers don't make preferential treatment regarding content they may not like or not like. As long as you are abiding by the rules of, say, you're not breaking the law, you're paying them for, you're keeping up on your bills, things like that, they're not to interfere in this. Right. They would like to interfere in this because that means that they can actually make preferential calls and make money as a result of that.
That's for people who, the Congress who support Betsy DeVos and those of us who don't support Betsy DeVos can't get her calls through.
Yeah, well, that's because of there. So many other people are calling in. So
I know.
Yeah, so that you know,
was an interesting thing that happened, that they shut the hotline down for the callers.
Yes, they did. But to be fair, they were also getting inundated. So in some respects, it's kind of, you know, the message was received.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know,
but still, but
anyway,
we digress.
Yes. We digress a bit. Net neutrality is the idea of extending this idea of common carriage to the internet. Internet service providers, especially where they're increasingly in monopoly positions, and mostly in the cable and telephone industries, and increasingly so on mobile as well, are not to give preferential treatment regarding the content of what's provided. It's not the case where, and we have seen battles of this in writ large, one classic example that's emerged in the last couple of years, Comcast is a rival of Netflix. And Netflix uses Comcast resources to stream content. Comcast also is a video provider of themselves, is in competition with Netflix. And so what do? They actually made Netflix an offer they couldn't refuse, saying, you pay us more to put your traffic through our pipes, or we're going to slow things down and make the viewing use of Netflix online a dismal experience. And that's actually what happened. You actually saw the record of them throttling content, throttling packets, the atoms of transmission of an internet communication across the internet. The atom of that is referred to as a packet. And you can analyze that at the level of a packet or do things like slow it down at the level of a packet, which is what Comcast did. And Comcast said, we're going to do this until you pony up. Pay us to speed things up.
Okay, here's an analogy for those friends of mine who are not on the internet. Just remember, like, you would be watching television in 1969 and you were trying to get the World Series Cubs game, and you were watching Channel 9, but you were watching it in Antioch in 1969, and you were trying to get a signal, and you were trying to pick up that signal, but you couldn't. All of a sudden, it just went out on you, even though, you know, you expected it, you were getting it before, and then all of a sudden, it went out on you. It's sort of like the same. It's a similar thing. It's not necessarily an exact analogy. But for those of you who don't know anything about these packets and internet, I just thought I'd chime in because I do have friends who really don't know what you're talking about.
That's okay. I do my best to try to lower it down. That's fine.
No worries. Yeah. You're saying everything makes sense to me, but I just thought, you know what? Because
maybe it's another example. Use the mail.
Yeah.
If you were to. You're expecting letters to come in from whoever, a family relative.
In Edmonton.
Yeah, in Edmonton, let's say. Okay. And it would be as if your postal carrier were to get a gun and to say, yeah, I'll give you this. You just pay me
$20.
Right. And
we'll give you the mail.
Yeah, yeah. Wait a minute. They already paid postage to send it to me. You're just supposed to deliver it.
It's from Edmonton, and their hockey team is bad.
But you see my point, is that those people who are doing the transmission from one point of contact to another are not to interfere with that, and certainly not to try to use their position, with their potentially received position, to profit for themselves. And yet, the big ISPs, the internet service providers, mostly the biggest cable and telephone companies that happen to have, by which most Americans access the internet in the United States, they see this as a golden opportunity to be able to make a lot more money than they currently do. And they have fought mightily hard.
And understandably so.
They've fought mightily hard to try to reverse this policy of non-interference of content, which has been formalized as net neutrality by a professor at Columbia University by the name of Tim Wu,
right,
who wrote this up in a paper back in 2002, where it turns out that there was not really a formal policy for this, of the idea of common carriage for the internet, so we invented it. And he referred to it as network neutrality, shortened to net neutrality, and then it became formalized. And
right.
it was after that the fight had been going on. That same year, the Federal Communications Commission ruled to actually change the internet from one set of rules, what's referred to as a classification, that basically kept this idea of neutrality at its heart, to one where it's markedly reduced. The formal terminology is it was reclassified from a Title II to a Title I. The communications law in the United States is divvied up into titles, and various communications media are allotted to a given title.
Right.
The FCC did a move that just unilaterally said, we're going to reclassify this. They actually are in that right to do that. But they better have, usually they don't do that without a whole lot of reasons, and especially where that can have very big impacts. Here, this was delivered as a big negative impact in the negative because it basically could, would remove that principle of neutrality. Comcast could, you know, shake down Netflix for money and your Netflix bill might be higher. Or if you're a political activist and they might say, okay, I'm going to make a website that's called IHateComcast.com because I hate Comcast and I want to, you know, I want to bring them out of business. And there's no shortage of complaints from Comcast. In fact, there have been investigations of Comcast by former Comcast employees to this score. So I'll compile them all into a website I'll call I Hate Comcast. Comcast gets wind of this and could say, we don't like your content, but we're not going to block you. No, no, no. That would be anti-free speech. But you got to pay more. Pay us double what you're doing for your terms of service every month.
Or they'll extort you in other ways.
Yeah, or they'll extort you in other ways, or they'll maybe subtly throttle, as they say. Mm-hmm. Reduce the speeds of transmission of this and make viewing IHateComcast.com more of a less pleasant experience.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and speed is everything.
Federal Communications does this the same year that net neutrality is actually coined. Mm-hmm. A legal fight then ensues that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. 2005. Brand X. This is Brand X versus NCTA is the name of the course.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm thinking Comcast is a totally different.
Yeah. Okay. But no, they're watching this closely because they know that if they win this, then that's actually a good thing for them. And it turns out that they do. Brand X, the FCC is actually affirmed with their the Supreme Court and in a 6-3 ruling realizes it's not probably the kind of thing you really should do. But you are well within your right to reclassify the internet if you so choose. And they didn't, and so they actually let it stand. Then it became a matter of trying to lock into law that decision, not just in terms of the policy, but to actually try to fight this where Congress would then say, you have to keep it that way forever. And the FCC's hands would be utterly tied, because they would say, even when, you know, liberal Democrats rather than right-wing Republicans may be in charge in the FCC, as was the case actually over the last 8 years, reasonably so, they would not be able to make that kind of action because they'd be forbidden by Congress from doing so. The FCC is a government agency that answers to Congress, so they're kind of tied on that. The fight then ensues over the course of the next decade in various fora, not only in Congress, certainly in 2006 with the law to actually try to lock that in, which we were able to block, called the COPE Act, but also in various legal actions where the FCC tries to enforce net neutrality, but with this weakened Title I reclassification, which a lot of people think is not the way you're going to do about this and actually will lead to your defeat in court. And that's actually what happens twice over. FCC nonetheless claims, mostly under right-wingers, but actually also under a Democrat, Julius Genachowski, who was your first FCC chair under President Obama.
Right.
They had actually enforced, it's like, okay, we're net neutrality. We abide by net neutrality. We're going to take people who violate that to court. Rather than concede to the concessions, they actually wind up getting sued. And the court recognizes that the policy is inconsistent with the classification, and as a result, they lose. The simple solution here, and one that a lot of people have been advocating for, is for the FCC to reclassify the internet back into one where that common carriage, net neutrality, the wonky term Title II, is restored back. And that had been the course of a fight over the course of roughly from 2014 to 2015, in a furious work of advocacy over the course of about a year.
Where the FCC got well over a million comments on net neutrality, it was just inundated.
It was more than that. 4 million pieces of correspondence that they had received. By way of comparison, that is the largest, most popular docket in the FCC's entire history. A lot of times, most dockets, if they get like 100 or 1,000, that's a lot. Here they got 4 million, and it had broken every record that the FCC had had for any docket.
That's breathtaking.
Yeah, and
I didn't know it was that high. I thought it was over a million.
It was over a million. I mean, a million would certainly raise eyebrows, but 4 million was the final estimated count. Yes, and they and That plus also with a number of lucky breaks, not the least of which was that we actually had a very good person who had worked on the net neutrality fight on the inside. I'm referring here to Gigi Sohn, who had basically been, who was a spokesperson on behalf of the Wheeler chairmanship of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, who had been FCC chair during Barack Obama's second term as president. But who had himself had a reputation as a lobbyist. He actually had worked as a corporate lobbyist and fundraiser for Democrats. That was a big reason why he actually wound up getting the FCC job. But to his credit, he actually understood these were the winds, where the winds were blowing. And while those corporates who had, corporations who had fought mightily for a non-neutral internet had very deep pockets and very robust connections. They did not have the numbers. The people had the numbers. Those who were working on behalf of freedom on the internet had the numbers. And I count myself as being a part of that movement. They had the numbers. They turned them out. And that was recognized by the FCC. Wheeler, with a 3-2 vote, enshrined that reclassification back. True to form, those corporate ISP types filed suit and lost, precisely because the that framework affirmed the neutrality actions they can take.
What was the venue for that? Was that
First Circuit Court of Appeals?
Okay.
It's almost always that's the Court of Appeals for Washington D.C.
Okay,
and that almost always is the venue for FCC policies.
Well, you know, and I don't think the First Circuit is all that.
It's not
the Ninth Circuit.
It's not. No, it has a very hostile reputation for liberal or left ideas.
Absolutely.
And the fact that it won there was read as a very good sign.
Yes. Yes.
Now, here's where we stand on this. Now, it's now 2017. We now have a Trump in the White House and not running as a Democrat, but as a very rabid right wing.
In the British form of the word, right?
Sure.
You know what Trump?
No, I don't, but.
I'll tell you.
Yeah, tell me later, off the air, and when you can actually use not for your language. But anyway, here's where we stand. It's 2017. We've had net neutrality for 2 years. It has been affirmed in court, is actually still fighting in court. Remember that en banc reference regarding the Ninth Circuit?
Yes.
Net neutrality is right now in an en banc appeal before the First Circuit. They're trying to get all, I don't even know, 19 judges to actually hear this? Good luck with that. They still might. The en banc proposal was actually filed back in June 2016.
But wouldn't they be able to, isn't it possible that they could railroad it in spite of it being the First Circuit? I mean,
Short answer is yes. I'll get to that in a moment.
I mean, I know that Bush did that after 9/11 with all of the people. There were a number of people who were in deportation from the Axis of Terror or whatever.
Yeah, Axis of Evil.
Axis of Evil, and a number of them had been in the system for a rehearing. Many of them had failed their federal court cases,
mm-hmm.
and of course the cases were under appeal through the Immigration Naturalization Service, but they were actually in the federal courts of appeal, and they were working their way up. But under a certain ruling by George Bush, he basically said, all of these have to be decided by a date certain. Could not Trump do the same thing with this this appeal for net neutrality?
He could, but the fact is that he's kind of fighting an uphill fight. Certainly within, I mean, that court has a fair amount of autonomy and is designed as such.
Okay.
And is also, it's very rare for them to take cases of any sort, especially one where it's been heard before and it's also pretty locked down regarding it. There's not really much in the way of a dispute here. And there are no other other courts that are, and it doesn't seem like that there's going to be much of a dividing line, not the least of which is that one of the judges that heard this is pretty well versed on the issue.
Okay.
And is a senior judge, and they're not going to want to try to usurp his authority and his knowledge on the topic. Yeah. Especially with a lot of judges who, yeah, you can get more judges, but if they don't know a lot about this and they're kind of deferring to the guy who did hear about this because he knows about it and has worked on it a long time, there, odds are that they probably will not take that up. Yeah. It'll probably, if it even gets heard, and the smart money has it that it probably won't. That won't succeed there. Now, it could be filed before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court there has got its problems, not the least of which it has 8 justices, but also where the Supreme Court, A, heard about this before and is probably not going to see the circumstances regarding this court case as wanting to pick it up again.
But
certainly not this soon.
Inundated with a whole bunch of other cases.
And they're busy besides on other things too. This is going to be a low priority for them in any event.
I would hope so, anyway.
The odds are that this is going to probably go nowhere as far as appeals up the food chain. But the problem now lies within the FCC itself,
right,
precisely because of this change of power in the White House is also mimicked at the FCC. Whatever party happens to be in charge of the FCC gets the majority vote, 3 commissioners at the FCC of a 5 commission hearing. The 2 remaining 2 seats are filled by the minority party. As the moment, we are now just have 3 commissioners of 5 seats, and we now have a new chair. Ajit Pai, he actually had been a sitting FCC commissioner for the last 2-3 years maybe. And after both 2 Democrats, one who had stepped down, your previous chair, Tom Wheeler, who actually had been, actually had like probably another 18 months or so in his term, but where he stepped down because that's what chairs usually do whenever there's a change in office. Sometimes they just even will bolt earlier than that. So he's left. He's going to the Aspen Institute, which is where FCC chairs go into their cooling off tank before they go back into the industry. The last 4 FCC chairs, when they left the FCC, joined the Aspen Institute.
What's the Aspen Institute?
The Aspen Institute is a think tank for policy things, and they're kind of a stepping stone for people to corporate for FCC types to go there before they go back into the industry where they work. And that's unfortunately the case here. You're talking about the revolving door. Yeah, it's a halfway house. It's a corporate halfway house. That's funny. It's a corporate halfway house. Yeah, I'm going to tweet that.
It's corporate halfway. It's yours.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Wizardress. So that's a corporate halfway house. But the point is that the Republicans now have the majority vote. Ajit Pai, who, along with Michael O'Reilly, the other Republican FCC commissioner, are now 2 of the 3 current sitting commissioners. Mignon Clyburn is the only commissioner of a Democratic from the Democratic Party still on the FCC.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the vote, but they don't have quorum, kind of. They would need and probably will get a 3rd Republican commissioner. Who we don't know yet. I've not heard any inklings of who would fill that slot.
I don't, you know what, Mitchell, I just interrupt you. Sorry. It doesn't sound good.
It's not good. And it's going to get worse. But bear out with me, because there are some signs of hope here still. And it's probably not going to come at the federal level. I have some famous quote about optimism. Oh, yeah, it's like the famous quote by Eduardo Galeano. Let's save pessimism for better times.
I gotcha.
Yeah, you know, it's like you got to be optimistic because it's too rational. You know, there's good reason to be pessimistic just by looking at things rationally. But that's not what an activist does. And going back into the points on activism here, activism tries to do what you can with what you have to try to improve things no matter the odds. And a lot of times the odds are arrayed against you, but that doesn't mean you don't fight.
Excellent.
And that doesn't mean you don't work to try to improve things however you do. Here, we'll get to that in a moment, but let's first lay the land out as far as the current terrain regarding net neutrality.
Okay.
As I mentioned, Republicans now hold the majority position there. They don't have a full complement. And also their policy, the open internet order, net neutrality, that Republicans have been chomping at the bit to try to remove or defang or reclassify or something, is right now mired in court. And probably will be for however long it takes. They'll probably be in chair for at least 2, probably 4 years until there is a new president in charge. Republicans will have, and even if, like, we'll even if say and the people have been talking about this, if Donald Trump gets impeached, you're still going to have a Republican president. And that will still mean that the FCC chair absolutely will still be Republican.
I know, I say that a lot. I like
it's crazy. I mean, it's like, I mean,
I can't think of a better word.
I mean, people have been asking about this, but even if you account for that, that's still what's going to happen.
I know.
So that means you're going to have to deal with the state of affairs probably for the next 4 years.
Congress and the Senate. I mean, that's the problem. And I keep telling that to people. I mean, you know, we're kind of all eyes are on Trump. But the other thing is, the Steve Bannon,
we can get to Steve Bannon later. Yeah, that's another kettle of fish.
Lay of the land here. I'm
sorry. So anyway, lay of the land here. No problem. No. We're all friends here. Lay of the land here. Republicans hold that majority. The two people who voted against net neutrality back in the open order vote of 2015 now have the majority now. And almost certainly, whoever the third Republican is that they'll get will be able to do that. So they're now, at least in theory, in a position to just overturn it. In practice, this is not going to happen overnight, and it's probably not going to happen for quite a while. We're talking a timetable here of upwards of a year or more. What's going to have to happen, even if you are a right-wing Republican bent on eliminating net neutrality, which has been on the books for the last 2 years and has been affirmed by courts, and will probably stay that way for at least the next few months, maybe longer still. You still got to go through the motions regarding the formal repeal of a rule. What happens is the FCC first has to announce a notice of rulemaking. They're basically saying, we're going to change things. They have to announce that. They have to have basically then two rounds of commentary, roughly about 45 days each, where people then respond to that proposed rule, and then people get a chance to respond to the responses to that rule.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to usually back it up with some evidence, usually some research of some sort. A lot of times, which I will bet you the FCC will probably farm out to one or more right-wing think tanks because they've done this before, or that they'll gin up research on their own side.
Oh, wait, stop there.
Yeah.
Okay, so they did that before? like the Heritage Foundation or something like that? Or what kind of right-wing...
It'll probably be something like the Heritage Foundation or the Aspen Institute or somebody who will probably... No, this has happened before. In the 2003 vote for that, they had to go through the motions regarding the media ownership rules. And they had to go through getting research to back up their claim, but the research was half-baked and probably had connections to these right-wing think tanks. It's like the rule that Bill Maher says in one of his new rules. You can't call yourself a think tank if all your ideas are stupid. And I think that applies here for the FCC as well. Yeah.
That's a good new rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was actually said right after the war of 2003. So it's kind of old, but it bears repeating. You can't call yourself a think tank if all your ideas are stupid. Or all the evidence that you're able to gin on this is stupid.
Now, wait.
All right.
Okay, I know this is off the subject a little bit, but not really. I'm just trying to ask for my own edification.
Mm.
Okay, so this is pretty typical, though, as I understand, that think tanks such as the Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, the Aspen Institute, I think there's another one.
The American Enterprise Institute is another of the big ones.
There you go. That's the one I was thinking of. That's the
AEI.
One that, that's the one that came up with the... we have to really beef up our military before the Iraq War. They did a whole, I read.
Probably bad research.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, or cherry-picked research or something.
Yeah. So a lot of governmental agencies do rely on the research of these private think tanks
mm-hmm.
that are usually funded by multi-million dollar corporations or individuals.
Yeah, there's a whole network of this stuff. And yeah, they need to... basically back up their claims, and this is one way they do it. Usually, and in fact, there's even a term for it. They're coin operated research. Anyway, going back to them now regarding the motions here. So FCC, even under the motions of wanting to, if you've got the entire terrain of changing this at your beck and call, you still got to go through the motions of the policy. So I mentioned you got to set up an announcement of the rule. You got to set up some research. Then you're going to actually write a draft rule. Then put that out for public comment, at least two rounds: one for comment to the policy, and then another round for comments to the first round of comments. And then, barring any other changes or revisions, and almost always changes like this tend to happen, especially given the amount of feedback that you'll have, you may or may not come up with a rule that you may then may or may not vote on. But if you're hell-bent on wanting to get this out, then you will probably write this to some capacity, or not even, you might write it yourself. You'll probably have one of your, you know, corporate teams. I'm also Ajit Pai, your current FCC chair, had worked as a lawyer for Verizon in the past, and not that distant past. So he's certainly got plenty of names in his digital Rolodex that he can lean on for, you know, writing the policies that they want, and which are probably already written and just ready to go. It just, you know, as soon as they get the clear to go, done. Or try to, or you'll have it done. You'll have it there. They'll take care of it for you. What we're talking about here is a timetable of, even under the best of circumstances, at least a number of months, more like 9, could be closer to a year or more. Now, here's the thing there. There are a number of actions that can be taken in opposition to this.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Now, at the level of the courts, the odds are not great to try to overturn this, because unless the criterion is whether or not the FCC ruling is, and the keywords are arbitrary and capricious, meaning are you not doing this at random, and are you not just doing it for the heck of it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the formal legalese. Unless there is like pretty hard evidence that that's the case, you're probably going to defer that to the FCC's authority, generally speaking. Usually do in any event, because the issues are so technical and so abstruse that they kind of defer on the people whose job it is to do this anyway. And they're kind of given wide latitude on that in any event. They were to the level of going up to the Supreme Court the first time this whole happened.
Right.
So they're going to try to do this again. But the thing is, the first time that happened is not the reason this is going to go through a second time.
Mm-hmm.
So the FCC may try to classify this out, but they will now, at least for the next 2 years, also have Congress at their beck and call, where they think they can probably get a formal lockdown of this in government policy, that the FCC can't reclassify it back. That's a very real risk that we face here. And so playing the game to stall things becomes very important, at least through the 2018 elections, assuming that this great movement of protest that we've seen just in the last 3 weeks since the inauguration can be translated into votes in 2018 that would just enough in at least one of the houses, probably the Senate. But I'll tell you this, the Democrats are really playing on defense. They've got to defend 10 seats in the 2018 senatorial elections. They just have to flip 2, but they've got a lot to have to defend. And the odds at the moment, I would not read, are great to do that. So we're talking to defend it, somehow hope you win that out of the next 2 years. But you still could have Congress say and order the FCC, okay, you've reclassified the internet to Title I, which is what the corporations want.
Right.
Lock it in forever. And yeah, Trump or Pence or whoever is going to, you know, succeed them both after Pence gets impeached because of some untold sex scandal that we don't know about yet, or some controversy that will probably embroil him too. Whoever is going to be, you know, holding that rubber stamp will probably approve that in as well, and would probably make net neutrality a distant memory, just as we had as movements in the past. So that's probably the possible scenario that we stand here. What do we do about this in terms of as things go? How can we stop this?
Absolutely. What do we do?
Okay. I don't think we could, while absolutely, yes, we got to try to make a ruckus, and we could try to gin up the works on the policy level.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we can do what we can to try to slow this down or muddy up the works on the policy front at the federal level, certainly. I mean, it's worked before. It even worked to the levels where I didn't think it would work. And we were able to win what we've got, at least, and to preserve what we've got.
One of the things that I noticed from the last internet net neutrality battle of 2015 was that it became a topic of living room conversation.
Yes, that will matter. This is not the kind of thing where it's just, you know, nerd heads and technical policy types, or even internet people who, you know, are into the abstruse details of how the internet works, that care about this.
Mm-hmm.
everyday normal people care about this too. I mean, where John Oliver will get millions of people to know about the issue by explaining it in a segment 20 minutes long on HBO, which actually went a far ways to helping to raise the profile of that. But I mean, the issue had been worked on for a long time to get to the point where John Oliver would look at this and say, hey, there's an issue here. We should make a segment about this. And they did.
Yeah.
And helped to raising it further. And this is where people know about this to the level where levels of unprecedented levels of correspondence came into the FCC. This is not the kind of thing that you want to try to screw around with blatantly, because you will probably have hell to pay if you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an avenue of hope that we hope will congeal into something positive in 2018 or 2020 or further down the road. I'm also thinking that perhaps another approach might be suitable here. The whole idea behind net neutrality is to formalize in law what the markets couldn't achieve, a diversity of providers for the internet. Because as is wont the case with markets, they will concentrate, and what had been hundreds of providers congeal to a handful, sometimes less. In the case of most of America, and by most I mean like upwards of 95%, the only two choices you have, if that, are the monopoly cable provider, like a Comcast or an RCN, or the monopoly telephone provider, like a Verizon or an AT&T, who call the shots on that. That's your choice. And a lot of times they work in cahoots with each other because they understand they're in a retrieved position. And those fights turn out to be kind of unnecessarily bloody among themselves anyway. A lot of times they'll work with each other rather than against each other because they know that that would be in their best interest to do so. But it would be against everyday Americans, you and me, who are negatively affected or potentially negatively affected by this.
The reason why this is so important for those of you whose eyes may be glazing over, because you and I, this is something we're passionate about.
The seventh time I think we've talked about this on WZRD
year. And the reason for it is because you and I both feel the same way about it.
Right.
We're on the same wavelength on it. And I feel like it is like, okay. It is a battle. And the reason why I do is because And I have to say this because it dovetails back to our previous conversation about resistance.
And this kind of goes back to my point regarding concentration of markets, particularly among cable and telephone internet providers generally. How do you break up that cartel? And I think one way to do that is to try to encourage local alternatives to local internet service providers that can provide that alternative or alternatives. We've actually seen examples about this that the FCC had actually affirmed in North Carolina and in Tennessee. The FCC, the same day that the FCC had voted on their open internet order, the net neutrality reclassification that actually a lot of people fought for and got a lot of play and attention, the same day, the same meeting, the FCC had affirmed the rights of local communities, particularly I'm going to probably get these wrong. Wilson, North Carolina, and a city in Tennessee. Was it Chattanooga or Murfreesboro? I'm not remembering. A city in Tennessee that both of whom had tried to set up their own local community fiber networks for internet access in opposition to the received cable and telephone providers who were afraid that this local version might be, and if not their death knell, would force them to compete and spend money they didn't want to have. They fought that. They actually fought in court after the FCC had actually affirmed their rights. And it turns out that these corporate ISPs in their respective states won and defeated both of those attempts, at least legally. They were there for the moment, at least locked into their immediate communities. They can't spread to other neighboring communities. And that's the threat here that I think we need to work on. Always the proverbial threat of a good example. We need to try to set up, in wherever communities we can, with whatever technologies are can, our own alternatives to try to fight this. And there are alternatives for that. We saw this in these examples in Tennessee and in North Carolina. We may want to lean on what they're doing and they're following on the technologies that the way they do.
Okay.
I'll mention the Princeton example as well, but go on.
Okay, hold on to the Princeton example. I just want to ask you a question.
Yes.
So with regard to the Tennessee internet fiber optic alternative,
mm-hmm.
One through court battle, what was the motivation behind the Tennessee government to implement this change?
They wanted faster internet, and they did not think that the incumbents, ISPs, were going to do that themselves because they were making too much money as is.
So they wanted to.
So they're just like, okay, screw you guys. We'll do it ourselves.
Okay.
And so they did. That's the motivation. They wanted cheaper, faster internet. And they had to do it themselves because Comcast or whoever wasn't doing it.
It was like a local city, or was it the state's attorney general?
No, it was the city.
Okay.
It was the local communities in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both pretty small cities in both. These are Republican states. But nonetheless, they were upset over the state of affairs regarding their own respective internet access to the point where they felt the local government had to step in to provide a better alternative themselves.
Do you think, is this becoming a trend? Do you think this might be something, or is this something that media activists are trying to get more state government?
It's been in waves back and forth over the last decade or so. I mean, even Chicago had flirted with the idea of a kind of community internet. We actually it was back in 2005, as I recall, where the city actually put out a request for proposals. It just got two bids, AT&T and Earthlink. And the city rejected them both, and they never said why. And that was apparently the last of it. I never heard since whatever happened with that. Odds are nothing has happened with that. That may be something we may want to fight for here.
Do you think that this might be something to sell
to
certain markets that are underserved?
Yeah, absolutely they'll be underserved.
I mean, I can think of several, like in New Mexico, for example, or not just New Mexico, but like states like New Mexico out west because of the mountains and everything, or out in rural areas where there isn't much internet access of the kind that you would get in a rural
Never
area.
Mind the kind of gigabit
right.
access that a lot of these places were actually setting up themselves. They were, not only was the fact that there was a competitor, but the competitor was basically beating them at their own game. They were providing far cheaper access and far faster access. I mean, imagine being able to stream a movie the length of Avatar in a matter of seconds. That's a long movie. That's 3 hours. But if it's fast enough to come down there, and you can do it for like $20 a month, are you going to switch? Heck yeah, you are. Do they want you to switch? Heck no. They're trying to do everything they can to stop it. Stopping their big one big motivation for trying to do that was basically it stopping it at state levels where they would lobby state legislatures and ask laws to say we don't want these, we don't want new rivals to emerge out from local communities or local governments. They usually have to get our approval. That's how they couch it. But they'll never grant it. And effectively, they're squelching out and keeping their received opinion. Their received position, excuse me.
Oh, my goodness. So, wow. That's...
Yeah, I mean, there are probably, I don't know, upwards of 20 states that have such policies on the books.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And they haven't implemented them because of the SEC? Or because...
They can't implement them because they're blocked at the state level. Because there's state law in these respective states says you can't do this. And so that's why a lot of communities are kind of stuck just with their incumbent internet service providers. But the possibility there is very ripe. I think if we just need the right, it could be some possibilities here for maybe some new or maybe even not so new technology to come to the fore. And that's where the Princeton example is going to come in.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about Princeton, New Jersey. I'm talking about Princeton, Illinois.
Okay.
This is a community that... In conference calls I had heard maybe about 8 years ago, I've not really had much follow-up since, they were trying to set up a kind of community internet, but they were doing that with this infrastructure, not copper wiring or fiber optic glass tubing, basically, where electric signals can propagate through as your means of the internet, but actually using electricity. They were actually trying to set up a community internet using the power grid that they already had. So that all that would mean is that if you had an outlet, a working outlet in your home, All you had to do was plug in a router to that that can actually get the signal and turn that into a Wi-Fi hub or a Wi-Fi router. Bingo. You're already on the internet. They don't need to build the infrastructure. They just use the infrastructure they already had in the form of a power grid. And that would make things dead easy as far as deployment and setup, as far as houses go. You don't need to have to dig up your neighborhood to lay in tubing or copper wiring or fiber optic cable or anything. If you've already got electricity, you've got the internet, provided by your local utility, in this case in Princeton, Illinois. Problem with this is that I have to admit I'm a little bit dated in my knowledge here. What I had last heard is probably upwards of about 6, maybe even as much as 8 years old. I have not really heard much since. I am hoping it's still around. If it is, it'd be a great thing to try to replicate, to try to fight for. There are examples I know, because in one case in Chicago, I know of one example of trying to build such an alternative. I was actually, I will not say too much in the details except to say that I have been involved in some of the technical infrastructure of the back end to try to do some kind of community internet initiative here in Chicago. There has been, I have not heard much of the way of the disposition of this in the last year. I hope it is still afoot. This actually may be a homework assignment for me to follow up on. Mm-hmm. But I think this would be the way to try to fight back regarding the net neutrality fight. Let 1,000 points of light, to steal a line from a Republican president, bloom regarding the internet, especially where technologies are increasingly more and more available. Let's use it. And there are lots of ways to be able to get the internet. I mean, you can use a phone or a cable, or in the case of what Princeton was working on, the electricity itself. You can also now use wire. You don't even sometimes even need infrastructure. You just use the airwaves itself. I mean, that's the whole point regarding cell phones. But I mean, you could also, depending on the portion of the spectrum that you use, now also use radio and telephone airwaves. Ideally, all you need to do is just plug something in and bingo. You don't even need, you know, if you've got electricity, you wouldn't need the infrastructure. You just get it from the airwaves. Now, that's also a big fight right now. In fact, with an auction that just last week concluded, where the FCC was auctioning off portions of the airwaves precisely for that purpose. So that radio and television waves are now, have just been sold off to internet service providers, large and small, for use as internet transmission using radio, what had been spectrum for radio and television broadcasts. They're now going to carry internet waves. How well that plays out, it's still a big question. I will tell you this, in the past, it has not been great, especially where a lot of times incumbents would just swoop in and outbid everyone by orders of magnitude. I remember one auction, which actually it had interviewed an attorney involved with it at the time, back in, this would have been about 2007, I think. And they had done a really big auction, maybe even 2008. They did a big auction, and AT&T and Verizon spent money like it was water. They spent like 80% of the money that was raised to try to buy out most of the spectrum and just sit on it, because they understood that that could be the beginning of a rival that could make them have to compete. And they don't want that.
So, you know.
So that's how I fight it, I think. We've got to try to build our own alternatives at the grassroots.
Well, I'd like, and a shout out to one of the listeners who called in from Lumpin Radio,
mm-hmm.
Who mentioned some historical precedents in Ireland, talking about the squelching and criminalization of resistance to power structures.
Mm-hmm.
So shout out to our allies in the fight, Lumpin Radio. Thank you for your service. We appreciate you, and I hope that the feeling, and I understand that the feeling is mutual. Right, because who has control over the airwaves has control over the truth.
Lumpin Radio may be in more of a received position than any of us know, because they have a broadcast license to broadcast radio. But they could do more with that spectrum than just radio broadcasts. They could allot a portion of it for transmission of internet packets. They could be their own ISP if they so choose. There's probably a lot of homework to do on that, but they've got the license. In theory, they could do it.
Right.
Now the homework assignment begins. Can that happen? And could that happen with other local low-power FM radio stations or broadcasters writ large, especially where radio stations are, at least among the corporate variety, in a world of hurt? And they may are trying desperately to try to still exist
right in
the midst of this. So what are they going to do? One thing they might do is maybe transform themselves into rival ISPs.
That could very well
which
be.
They would broadcast, where instead of not just broadcasting a radio signal, provided they would be broadcasting internet transmissions.
Provided that they themselves are not slurped up by...
No, I mean, now suddenly Clear Channel, or what had been Clear Channel, what's now iHeartRadio. Yeah, but I mean, they could turn their... I think there are upwards of 600 radio stations into 600 ISPs, but yeah, and they could overnight, if at least in theory, become, you know, a rival to AT&T and Verizon and Comcast. But I mean, this is a pretty rabid right-wing company with a very sordid history. I don't know if I necessarily trust them as being an ISP.
Right. Well, but we when we first met back at the media consolidation conference for Free Press back in 2005, I think it was. And we met before that. We were at various meetings.
Yeah, the National Conferences for Media Reform.
Right, exactly.
The organization Free Press has held them 6 times in the last 14 years. The most recent was in Denver in 2013.
Yes, it's been a while since they had a conference. But,
yeah.
But the thing is, I remember when, you know, going to all the panel discussions and everything, that this was not necessarily a partisan issue in the end. That this is not a left versus right. This is about access to information. And so no matter who control, the problem is having a democratization of the airwaves and keeping it that way for all perspectives to be welcome and not squelched.
Yes, and that actually, the examples that the FCC had leaned on and recognized both came from admittedly Republican states. I have to admit, I don't know the political orientations of the mayors of Wilson, North Carolina, or Chattanooga, Tennessee, but I can gather that they know that they want fast, cheap, good internet, and they also want to have the freedom to be able to express their views, whatever they are. That those are values that I hope transcend whatever political disagreements or divides we may have, and which is why I have hope that we can win on this, precisely because those values do transcend those lines. The typical dividing, you know, left versus right, whatever that's supposed to mean, would be dissolved away versus an up or down. The people versus, in this case, the corporations, and particularly corporate ISPs.
Right.
That could be the new dimension on this fight, and that would be, I like our chances in that kind of fight.
I think if we were able to build certain levels of coalitions, you know, with all different kinds of people on the political spectrum to show that this is an issue that affects them.
If there's a more hope on this score, it's that in the case of a lot of the media fights I've been involved with, that kind of crossing of typical political divides is why we won and has happened. It certainly was the case in the media ownership fight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I said that word again. I'm sorry. I was going to just find myself.
Yes. Totally.
Oh, yes. Totally. Yes, yes, yes. And I'm here.
Groovy beans, man.
Absolutely. I don't know. I love that word. And I think I guess I'm thinking about absolute truth and the truth and who monitors the truth. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's why I'm so passionate about net neutrality, because it is a way of obtaining the truth. We could go on. We both talked about fake news, right? Briefly, we touched on that. That was a media that was covered in the media about these fake posts and Facebook and so on and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
but ultimately, it is about who owns the truth. Who has a monopoly of the truth? That, I think, is the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I know that I'm speaking kind of in grandiose terms, but I don't think so. I mean, it is... Who do you believe, really, in the end?
And the answer to that should be that should be for you to decide. And you should basically have the freedom to hear various forms of opinion and make your call based on that. And that's actually a good thing, to be able to hear these kinds of points of different perspectives and opinions. And that you would hope that something resembling the truth comes out of that. And that's why I'm actually hopeful on this score, that these kinds of media issues do transcend those typical political or ideological divides, that because they resonate more widely. It might be the left or something deemed the left that might start the ball rolling on it, but it wouldn't stay there. And that actually is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think the left alone will win this. It hasn't in the past. We've been able to win this precisely by transcending those previous divides, and it to some success. We've been able to win things.
Yes.
And I hope we will continue
and
here
I
as well.
I caught myself.
That's okay.
It's like when I was in Toastmasters, they had an counter, so anytime you gave a speech,
you had to say
an you had mm-hmm. to pay them at the end of the meeting.
Oh, how much was it? Like $5 an
Yeah, well, I definitely owe you a big dinner at Satay.
Pay the rent, yeah.
For the amount of times I use the word absolutely. Oh, I use it again.
No.
I get you dessert. All right. Okay.
All
right. I'm trying to get some, we're trying to laugh, right? We're trying to laugh because we are dealing with interesting times, are we not?
Yes, in the ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times,
this
in that sort
true.
Of sense of the word.
This is true.
Yeah, and we live in probably the most interesting times, maybe in all of history right now. But what we are seeing, not just in the fight regarding net neutrality now and in the past, and also with the protests, the remarkable resurgence of protests that we've seen, and it's actually, all signs are, it's continuing and spreading and broadening. In fact, just yesterday, I saw an article in The Nation magazine where they had to list out a whole lot of follow-up actions and efforts and initiatives of varying sorts. They got 45. You can look it up at thenation.com, and they've, or...
It is,
yeah.
It's a very good issue. I read The Nation,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, you see my point is that, you know, people are getting involved, and that's what will matter here. Especially in this critical juncture that we face, there's this rare opportunity where the work you do will have an outsized impact on what's to follow, not just now and in the days to come, but perhaps for the next generation or so. And we're right now in the middle of it. You have every reason to get involved. Yes, the odds are stacked against you, but I'll say this as having been involved in political activism now upwards of 14 years, the odds have always been stacked against you. That doesn't mean you just curl up and go into a ball. You fight. You do what you can in whatever way, large or small, you can, and you keep doing it. That's how you win things.
And that's how, ultimately, in conflict, we evolve to a higher level of consciousness and understanding of what is true.
Mm-hmm.
At least in my opinion, and that's just my opinion. With that being said, I don't know if you want to cover anything else, Mitchell. We have some extra time.
You tell me. Well, first let me ask, how much extra time do we have?
Until my colleague gets here.
Okay.
So we have, let's just say for, about 10 minutes.
Okay. I myself did not have anything particular to talk about. Is there something you would like to discuss or raise?
I think we're good. And
okay.
I think we have, we covered all the points.
Okay.
On our
I will say this. Actually, let's go back to the FCC for a moment regarding
Ajit
Pai.
Sure. Yeah, we have time. So
yeah, we have some time. So we'll return back here to the FCC and what the current agenda is for the moment. We now actually have, even though he's only been appointed chair about a couple weeks, Ajit Pai, who is now your current FCC chair, is now, in fact, just last Friday, was it? It was February, I'm looking at the date here, I think it was, February 2nd. So we're not talking, today's the 12th, 10 days ago. That was on a Friday. And he basically unilaterally announced a bunch of rather drastic anti-public actions. One of them is actually directly connected with net neutrality, ending the inquiry on zero rating of internet access, What does that mean, Mitchell? Well, zero rating.
Thank you for asking me.
No problem. I figured most people wouldn't know that term, but it's actually pretty substantial and very connected to the issue of net neutrality. And it is a bad thing that he did. Let me first explain what's going on here.
Okay.
It's the previous chair, Tom Wheeler, had inquired into the use of internet service providers to give preferential treatment to their own content regarding data when it comes to data quotas. So it put this into more specific terms. Say you're a subscriber to AT&T and you also get DirecTV because AT&T bought out DirecTV despite popular opposition against it. You could use DirecTV for your TV access or some TV access because you're an AT&T subscriber now. But the thing though is, if you were to use, you could watch DirecTV and not have the data usage count against you in your quota.
Okay.
And that's deemed a possible violation of net neutrality. In order to look into the issue, they opened up this kind of zero rating. The idea that you shouldn't, because you're not penalized for it, hence the name zero rating. But that's still giving preferential treatment to content, and that would, in the spirit of things, violate net neutrality. Tom Wheeler had opened an investigation on that. Ajit Pai, on February 2nd, formally closed it. The FCC has said, we are not going to find out about this. Along the lines of, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah, don't ask, don't tell. It's just like, I'm not going to formally investigate that. He doesn't want to know that there's a problem because there probably is one. But it bodes very poorly regarding the actions he will probably try to take. But this is not a surprise to anyone who's paying attention. He's probably going to try to kill net neutrality as soon as he possibly can. And he's already taken an action to even kill the inquiring about its impact with this closing of the inquiry. It's bad news already. Worse, on the matter regarding internet and access, a number of companies have actually been trying to themselves, under FCC, with FCC assistance, trying to set up low-cost internet access to poorer communities. There was a consortium of 9 companies that actually were working with this. The FCC actually stopped that subsidy and those initiatives. They were going to subsidize the broadband to the poor through these 9 companies, and Ajit Pai put a stop to that the same day that those and 7 other actions. I'll refer to a blog post on the Benton Foundation's website at benton.org, BENTON.org. Look for a post called, Is This What Transparency Looks Like? Dated on, actually just on Friday, February 10th, but referring to actions of just the week before that, February 2nd. 9 actions, all dumped on a Friday afternoon, which, as Ask Any Journalist, is basically the dead of winter as far as trying to raise awareness about this, about things. Not the time, usually you put things to go to die, because they could, in this case, it would mark very badly as far as Ajit Pai's term as an FCC chair. He is basically going to play for his former paymasters. And he has now laid the gauntlet down. He will continue. We have to do what we can to fight.
And that is a strategy that lawyers do. They'll file a motion or something like that. That's mm-hmm. very controversial, usually on a Friday, because they know that in law firms, typically their staffing is low and they don't have the ability to respond quickly.
Right, right. Same thing with journalism there. Most people aren't paying attention on a Friday afternoon
exactly.
They want to get to the weekend, they want to head home.
Exactly. Yeah. And so understandably. And so that is one of the things that, having a lawyer in the FCC.
Well, you've had lawyers at the FCC. Are they good or bad lawyers? Here we have
corporate.
Good and bad in the sense of, are you working for the people or for the corporations?
Are you working for the good of the law also? And I have to add as well, because, you know, you have lawyers that work on both sides who are not necessarily working to improve the quality of justice by any stretch. So
certainly. But Ajit Pai has already, just a couple weeks into his term, has already done some very bad things.
That's because he's got a mandate from his master.
Yes, he does.
So,
fight is already underway. We will endeavor to do it. And
so, what is Chicago Media Action doing? I mean, what are we doing locally here?
Locally, we are the big focus, at least as far as CMA is concerned, is actually with regards to CAN-TV. Chicago Access Network Television, our main cable provider. There are some political potential changes that may be afoot there.
Okay.
Not necessarily a bad thing. There are some potential changing of the guard. From what I understand, I think your current chair, Barbara Popovich, mm-hmm. is probably going to be retiring soon. These are the words I'm heard. I have to admit, I don't know offhand, firsthand, so I may be open to correction on that. But there is a very real, people read that as both a fear that her successor may be not as good as she was as far as fighting on behalf of the public and keeping CAN-TV a strong resource.
Accessible to
the absolutely. Public. Yeah, no. There have been a number of fights on there. She has been a more than able fighter, and a lot of what we've won regarding CAN-TV is to no small extent a credit to her work and persistence on the issue for quite a while. Oddly enough, she actually herself was a former corporate type. She actually used to work for NBC Chicago way back when, but actually changed stripes, and a good thing too. Not only probably has she benefited, but I think we have all benefited from her work on behalf of public access in Chicago. The question though is, what's the follow? And there is also an opportunity here regarding what policies might the CAN-TV implement as far as its own staff and decision making apparatus are concerned. There has been some effort to write in and revise some changes to keep things more broad, especially when it comes to decision making. We have seen in Chicago protests and fights just to try to get an elected board. In for example, the Chicago Public Schools, which are, as it stands, appointed, not elected. There's a very real fear that could happen for CAN-TV, and so there's one push to try to shoot for elected, not appointed, positions there. So that is another point of contention that people are working now and fighting on. Chicago Media Action is aligned with those efforts, and we will continue to work on that. You'll find a number of posts a little bit on the stale side, but not too much, mostly from November and December, on our website at chicagomediaaction.org that spell out some of the details and what's been going on. So, okay. Yeah.
That's good.
So that's some things there.
All right.
And also, I'll refer to our Twitter feed. We're also on Twitter where we post things, not just about what's going on CAN-TV, but on media things writ large, around the clock, all the time. The Twitter handle is Chai Media Action, C-H-I Media Action, spell it out.
All right, Chai Media Action.
On Twitter. Okay. Yep, that's the Chicago Media Action Twitter feed.
Okay.
Yes. Just trying to get It'll be there all day.
All right, good. And that really should be it.
Okay.
We are going to transition wizards now. But I wanted to thank you profoundly from the bottom of my heart for coming on.
You're very welcome, Wizardress.
Yes, because this is an important issue, and I think because of the technical nature of it, and for a lot of people, it is kind of obscure. Not too many people discuss net neutrality at a dinner conversation or at a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is something that's becoming more and more, I guess you can say, mainstream. And it is becoming more important to people as we begin to see the more consolidation and commercialization and corporatization of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been ongoing, and it's becoming more so and more so and more so. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We had a very stimulating conversation, lots of food for thought. Anything else you would like to add before
I'm good for now.
We conclude?
I'll refer people to the website chicagomediaaction.org, also chicago.indymedia.org, IndyMedia.
Can anyone post anything on IndyMedia?
Yes.
Does it have to be
vetted? No, it is a public newswire. We just ask that it abide by the policies of the newswire. We we will block out any explicit advertising.
Okay.
And anything that is also anti-fair speech. So no sexism, no racism, no homophobia, nothing like that. But aside from that, people can and do post things in on a variety of different topics with a variety of different perspectives and even different languages. So that as long as you abide by the policies of the newswire, yes, it's open and you're welcome to post.
All right, great. And anything else that newbies can read or anything that you would recommend someone who's sort of new to this topic?
Yeah. Well, there's both the appetizer and the main course. I will mention. I'll plug Free Press. They're probably maybe the leading popular-minded organization on media policy stuff. They've been around for quite a while. I've been good friends with a lot of the staff and certainly the founders of the organization. Freepress.net. You can learn more about them. And also they keep up on a lot of changes, especially as things break from day to day and from time to time on a variety of media related issues. So that's one good entree to finding out about this. If you want the main course, you really want to dig into the details on this, there is probably no better resource I can recommend than the Benton Foundation's newswire. Benton.org, Benton. They are they're actually a nonprofit foundation founded by the late Charles Benton, who passed away last year, maybe a couple of years ago. He had understood that that media was an issue, and he founded a foundation whose raison d'être, whose reason for existing and the work is on media and the policies that shape that. That website has a staggering amount of information and updates. If you really want to get it all, there's no other resource than that. A word of warning, it's like drinking from a fire hose.
It really is.
I mean, on my own news feed, as I'm catching up on it now, I am down to 735 unread articles in the last, like, I don't know, 4 months, 4 weeks or so. It is a lot to take in, but if you want more, if you want more than just the 101 resource and to go into advanced graduate seminars on media policy and to get into the finer details and also to cover things that wouldn't get covered and where people sometimes miss, that's your thing.
Yeah.
The Benton Foundation's website.
Definitely.
Nonpareil for that.
That's the best.
So yeah, if you're into you want to get up to the date and get briefings on keeping up on the latest things, freepress.net. If you really want to go the extra mile, benton.org.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. All right. I think that should conclude our meeting for today. Let's agree to convene sometime in the future.
Yes.
Maybe next quarter.
After Trump gets impeached?
Maybe after the first 100
days.
If he makes it that long.
Yeah,
if
probably
we
not.
Make it that long, oh my goodness.
I hope so.
I'm thinking more in terms of like closer to the fall, if we're still here, literally here, you know?
We will work together to figure out a schedule.
Okay, that's fine. Or as things come up, I think as needed. I am thinking more in terms of getting other kinds of resistance fighters on the air to talk about their activism while we still can and while we're still able to here at the Wizard.
Yeah.
Because of the history of, and I mentioned that because of the history of the Wizard, we, don't take anything for granted. And we don't take our mission and our responsibility for granted either.
Yes.
So hopefully, good Lord willing, and the creeks don't rise, whatever Lord you believe in, that won't happen, and we will be able to talk in the future. So if you know what I'm saying. Okay, with that thought in mind, I'm going to switch back to the music, and we're going to transition to our next Wizard. So once again, thank you so much, Mitchell, for coming over.
You're very welcome.
All right. Well, let's listen to some more Italian pop music from the 1950s here at The Wizard. Yes, this is WZRD Chicago. I need to identify us. This is WZRD Chicago 88.3 FM on your radio dial. Thanks so much for tuning in. It is always an honor and pleasure to serve you, the greater WZRD listening community. I wish you all a great and fantastic week, and namaste.